Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Absolutely, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring. There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dad!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on the spine.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Oh.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Okay.
Where's my assistant? I do not know. Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzock of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that? This is great banter.
Yeah.
Monkey tennis?
Back of the net.
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, where we are working our way through Alan's own podcast from the Oast House, Series 3. I'm Adam Brooks and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Come to old leisure, where fitness is pleasure.
Nick Older.
Lynn, this isn't about your great detective work, it's about me being flabbergasted.
And Tom Stapp.
There's only so much you can say about fucking horses.
So today we'll be tackling episodes 5 and 6 of Alan's own podcast, but we're also taking a look at the promo that's been going out around, ahead of, and amongst from the Oast House Series 3. Tom Dark has got this week's tits bits.
So this week I thought it was worth dropping in the YouTube/TV advert for Series 3. So let's just, we'll drop that in now and then we can see what we've all got to say about it.
Musketeers, stooges,
little pigs,
wise men,
the legs of a milking stool,
Billy Goat's Gruff.
All the best things come in threes, and that includes from the Oast House, now in its third series. Ah! And while some things, e.g. kids, can become tiresome after the first two, I can say with my hand on my heart that the third series of From the Oast House isn't appreciably weaker.
From the Oast House, the Alan Partridge podcast series 3. Listen now.
Yeah, so there we go. That's that was the advert that was on telly and on YouTube. I think that was pretty much when Series 3 was announced. That was, I think, the first thing we saw. So you've got Alan in this red polo neck, brown leather jacket, kind of pointy shoes, winkle picker vibes. What do we think about that?
I think it sets the tone quite nicely. The highlights for me are the joke about not having more than two kids. And also the joke about it not being appreciably weaker. So an admission in his own mind that he knows it is weaker, but it can't be proven, so that's fine.
Yeah. or certainly that many, many comedy vehicles come season three are probably diminishing returns. So just recognising that the people might be thinking that, but that it's not true.
I think there's quite a skinny Gene on Alan in this promo as well, which seems a bit of a change for the character perhaps. But then I guess, we had almost the Man from Del Monte type vibes with series two, with the kind of the neckerchief and the white suit. So yeah, it's interesting to see predominantly the fashion choices for the Oast House promo. I think that's always tells us something. I mean, there was also the promo shot of him reclining in some kind of hammock, looking far too relaxed, I thought.
I'm also enjoying the consistent trope of Alan sort of jumping, or whenever he kind of has to do anything slightly strenuous, his knees either cracking or giving way, or like in that piece where he jumps off the gate. But then also that was in Stratagem as well, where the Shadow sort of iPod advert, where he was sort of dancing around and he sort of grabs his knee. always fun.
So good. That is so good. That was definitely that is the funniest thing about Stratagem, those kind of fake iPod ads. That's as good as it got.
His creaky knees were always put to good use. Good gag in this time as well, I thought. I just love the fact that the next shot in that trailer, he's visibly limping as well.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
A great tale. I also think it's
sort of come in tandem with his move to the countryside as well, hasn't it? Now he has to deal with a lot more gates, stiles, fences, permissive pathways, etc. It's really causing havoc to his lower leg. So that's the promo out of the way. We're going to tackle the first of two episodes that we're covering today, with episode 5 entitled Jingle, which clocks in at 22 minutes, 23 seconds. Tom, can you let us know how Audible described this episode?
Yeah, channeling the great rock stars of old, Alan spends a night in a recording studio. Pretty short. Doesn't give too much away there with the plot.
No. Although you could deduce from that and the title alone that he's not going to be recording his magnum opus. We're not going to get a Dreams or a Nevermind out of the back of this. And as it turns out, we'd be lucky to get a new jingle. It emerges quite early on that he can't do a legitimate Bee Gees impression, and there's some mild transphobia in the first sentence. I wonder, in terms of sort of racism, homophobia, transphobia, the big three, if you will, whether the writers sit down and think, okay, so Alan will be sort of visibly right on about this, prejudice. This next prejudice, a little bit less so, but then I think they've almost identified transphobia as the one that Alan is still not really, still doesn't quite know what to say, still hasn't quite got to grips with it. And I feel like they can kind of use these sort of waves of prejudice to sort of pin where Alan's at.
Much with the sort of later incarnation of Alan, he'll get there, but it's taking a little bit longer.
He runs off a list of all the people he's sung with. Many of them we know are accurate because we've seen them. It's been sort of, for comic relief or so on. Did anyone fact check the full list?
I didn't fact check it, but I thought I just really enjoyed that. I like when we get a reference like this in the APU, where it gives us a bit of a glimpse into like the showbiz life that you had before things fell apart. I just think it's quite fun that you get kind of references to things that we haven't seen in shows, which kind of indicates that at one point Alan was in a bit of a celebrity kind of collective in a way, perhaps not A-list celebs. The list is quite funny. Does anybody have it written down?
No, go for it.
You go for it.
So I think he says, I've sung with Elton John, Cliff Richard, Michael Ball, Edward Woodward, the White Equalizer, and that was all at Terry Wogan's memorial. Which is, I guess, also the weird thing is, obviously, when Terry Wogan passed, that was well after Alan had fallen foul of the BBC probably more than once by that point, so his career was already on the ropes. But, the implication is that he had formed friendships with people at a time when he was more successful, I think.
Or do we think that he basically uses BBC connections at the time to swing an invite to Wogan's funeral, and that actually, rather than this being a sort of a setup with friends, it's more,
Elton John and a few people were sharing a song around a piano at the wake, and Alan's just sort of stood behind them singing.
That's probably a more accurate read.
Yeah,
to be
that's
fair.
It. Isn't
yeah.
it?
I wasn't thinking about the time of it. I think if he'd been talking about something in this being a moment back in the '90s, that would make sense. But I think in terms of it being Terry Wogan's memorial, which I mean is more recent, yeah, I think that's a very good read.
So he's having a fight with Nathan Giggs, his producer. He also stresses that he's having a hiatus from TV. In Alan's mind, he's not done for good. He's rolling through nicknames for Nathan to try and get released from the studio. Nate, Nattles.
Naz.
Tell this bit when he's having this argument about... So he's saying that he thinks Nathan is a genius, but reckons if he stopped three other people in the street, they wouldn't agree or know who Nathan was, unlike if Alan was doing the same about him. And... I like that, you know, this is a classic thing now where his own imagination lets him down. So even if he's imagining five people he stops on the street to all be fans of him, even that doesn't work. He's still got people saying, no, but she's 18, false eyelashes, drawn on eyebrows, big lips, not my demographic. And yeah, exactly that line. Isn't that the guy that used to be on telly, still on telly, just taking a hiatus? So he can't even imagine five people all being off the bat positive about him. It's brilliant.
My notes at this point as well, just wanted to mention something that's happened in previous series, that he seems to have entirely forgotten his cliffhanger from episode 4. Those of you that joined us last week will remember that that there's reason to believe that Michael is alive, but that has been entirely abandoned by the time we get to this episode.
Although I do kind of think that is, you know, if we're kind of extrapolating the fact that this is actually Alan Partridge doing a podcast, if we take that as and he's often talked about like his relationship with Amazon and Audible about having to sort of like generate tension and like make the content sticky and things like that. It's quite a well-worn trope of certainly literature where you would have like a big cliffhanger at the end of a chapter and then it would go into a whole new section about someone else or something else. So part of me wants to give him a bit of a benefit of the doubt where he is... making us wait for it and making us wait for... Or all this stuff is happening on in the background and he hasn't yet received that email from Lynn, which has the link to the CCTV footage. So even though Michael... The carrot has been dangled, maybe all that stuff is still going on in the background and he hasn't actually got an update for us anyway.
So for once you're saying it's not down to ineptitude, it might just be the way things are.
Maybe it's 20% ineptitude.
One of the things I was enjoying was... this is described as a songwriter's masterclass with Nathan Griggs and, you know, touched on all the kind of different instruments. But part of this masterclass involved hand claps. And I kind of wondered to what degree you can get into a masterclass around the use of hand claps.
I do think that there is a bit of subtext here around Nathan having ideas above his station and presenting himself as being much more an integral part of the music industry than he actually is. More of that to come, but I think that's the start of it. To have the hubris to be hosting a songwriter's masterclass where it's largely hand claps.
Yeah. Well, what does that Alan say? Is it Alan says that they're two songsmiths at the very top of their game?
Yeah.
That he's a co-writer, collaborator, producer, and prodigy.
Self-professed.
Yeah.
Self-identified as...
It's a window into the creative process of songsmiths. Well, actually, you know, by the end of the episode, we do get to see the fruits of Alan's creative process, and it's not terrible. So, you know, maybe he's right.
I liked as well that the fact Alan is locked in the recording studio is a nice bit of a reveal. We don't know that straight away.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, there's a bit of an argument going on, but the fact he's actually locked in, I thought was quite nicely done. The way they bring that into it.
There's quite a few of these comedic reveals, aren't there? Like when he nearly breaks to strike at the hospital in the previous hospital radio episode, it turns out he's broadcasting from the footwell of his car.
I've only just noticed this, but obviously when I did my notes for this episode, I've got my first note is like Alan's on the phone to Nathan. I assumed they were having a phone conversation. We were only hearing one side, but then yeah, the reveal is that he's locked in the studio and it's 1 a.m.
I think even. Like, yeah, it's often the reveal being the location, because I think actually it's happened a lot throughout Oast House, like I think all the Oast House series. Often he'll be doing some kind of voiceover, monologue, whatever you want to call it, and then there's a reveal that he's in the car, he's driving, or he's in the car with another person, even. That seems to happen quite a lot.
I did do a little bit of research into the accuracy of some of the locations referenced here. So obviously you've got Holt Leisure, where business is pleasure. Holt Leisure does exist, but bizarrely, given the name, it's a marina in Scotland. I also wanted to check that there is actually a recording studio in central Norwich. And it turns out there are tons of them. So you've got Plug, you've got NRSIX, Art Sciences, Pirate, just a few of the genuine recording studios in the middle of Norwich. So Alan says that it's they're running till just after 1 a.m, recording through the night, that they've got a Studio 54 vibe, which for anyone that's ever read about or seen the biopic about Studio 54, couldn't be further from the truth. They're only going to stop when one of three things happens. Does anyone have this list? It's when the creative juices run dry, when the cleaner arrives, or when Alan has to have a nap on the camp bed.
The rock and roll lifestyle that he references is definitely there as well. He talks about rock stars of old smoking big crocs of rack. Another Alan-ism there. But I did enjoy that he has also succumbed to the excesses of the rock and roll lifestyle in the form of delicious clotted cream fudge, which he describes as wonderfully Moorish, along with cocaine, which I thought was great.
His list of rock star examples before that as well. So he reels off Jagger, Bowie, Richards, Keith, not Cliff, Bolton, and Barlow. Thought that was very fun, including Gary Barlow on the end of a list there. And yeah. I think Alan lists three kind of examples of rockstar excess, which are copious amounts of beer, being taken in the mouth by groupies, and, as Nick says, smoking big crocs of rack. So that is the template for the rockstar lifestyle there.
But yes, Alan's gone down the fudge route, which I thought is the closest we've sailed to old Toblerone territory for some years. So keeping an eye on Alan's welfare. Another thing I liked on the subject of cocaine was that he says, according to Nathan, insiders describe Rumours as Fleetwood Mac's cocaine album. Now, that is a fact so widely available that the fact that it's insiders describe it that way and it's according to Nathan makes me think that Nathan clearly thinks that he's a bigger part of the music industry than he is. The idea that is any sort of industry secret is ludicrous.
I kind of read that more, though, that Alan is oblivious to probably the most widely known fact of kind of a big album of the last however many years, and Nathan's just telling him that as new information when pretty much everyone else in the world knows the story of that album.
Hasn't Alan previously referred to them as soft rock cocaine enthusiasts?
That's Iggy Pop.
No, I thought that was Fleetwood Mac.
Ooh. So I think it's Mid Morning Matters. He refers, it's an intro where he describes them as soft rock cocaine enthusiasts.
Should we go to a live Google?
I'm doing a live Google to the Fact Cave. Guys, I'm back from the Fact Cave, and I can confirm Stab is right.
It makes even more sense when you consider he then goes on to talk about how he likes Stevie Nicks' pragmatic, creative solution to doing coke up the bum to avoid septum damage. Oh, and then has to clarify that isn't what's meant by crack cocaine.
That's low-hanging fruit, but that is a good gag still.
Yeah, yeah.
Did we all enjoy the bit about Alan's groupie and her unsolicited feet pictures?
Yes.
So yeah, a groupie sent Alan pictures of her feet, but it turns out only because she mistook him for a chiropodist, and this was only clocked when he reciprocated and she called the police.
But they are friends now. He had to add that they are friends now.
Yeah. Whether it's sending unsolicited sexual pictures of his own feet or cutting someone up in a lay-by, he does seem to end up friends with most of the people that he has serious falling out.
Yeah, he always says that, doesn't he? Like, they'll always fall out, and then the kind of payoff will be like, but we're friends now.
That goes one of two ways. It's either that is how he's forming friendships, or the unreliable narrator is back, and he's not friends of any of these people.
I like that we get a actual physical description of Nathan. Has anyone got this down?
Just that he has a ginger afro and is chubby, but I think it's probably Alan does it in better terms than I have.
He says he has a ginger afro, so he already looks like his head is exploding.
which Alan has used on Lynn before, when he referred to her hair as an explosion. So he's got form for referring to people's hair as that in that sense.
There's another repetition here as well. Doesn't he also say that his hair looks like a flare stack?
Yeah,
which was a reuse of the John Baskill description, which is always enjoyable.
And Alan describes himself in terms of how he differs from Nathan in that Alan is more of a maverick, but he does say that he likes TVs and cars too much to throw them out of windows. Now, obviously, throwing TVs out of windows is the rock and roll cliche. Don't think anyone's ever knowingly thrown a car out of a window, but we'll give it to Alan. In terms of Alan being more of a maverick, does anyone have the list of his risk-taking behaviours?
Could we perhaps discuss what is the most maverick thing out of these four? So, yep. Number one, numero one, is drink a warm fizzy water before an important meeting. Number two is go to bed in the nude. Number three is don't say goodbye at the end of the phone call. And number four is eat a sandwich whilst driving. What is the most Mad Dog maverick thing there?
Perhaps this could be a poll on our socials as well.
Oh, that's a great idea. I mean, for me, there's one answer here that is lunacy, and I will go to battle for it.
Go on, Alan. See, I think they're all acceptable behaviours, but one of them is taking more of a risk than the others.
Nude sleeping should be outlawed, and it is for mavericks only. I always just think of the bedsheet risks. That's where my mind goes.
That sounds more like a you problem than anything else.
That's a little insight into your life there, Nick.
Sounds more like a hygiene reveal.
No, for listeners who listened last week, where I gave a very thorough explanation of how I ensure the cleanliness of the toilet, which does extend to the bed, but I do firmly believe that anyone who sleeps nude is not only shaking things up, but an absolute bed maverick, and it should be outlawed.
Interesting that you've said that the toilet extends to the bed, because that does remind me of another story that we probably don't have time to get into today.
Not now. One day.
I think eat a sandwich while driving is genuinely the riskiest of these very low risk behaviours.
I would agree.
I mean, well, you could argue that one is genuinely, well, that's genuinely dangerous in terms of you then only have one hand free for the steering wheel. You could lose control of your vehicle, Nick.
It would be genuinely dangerous if I found myself somehow naked in bed with Nick.
I would not go to bed naked, but if I ever go to McDonald's, which I have to drive to, I will...
You go there naked.
I will always drive there naked. That is... but I will always have a cheesy bee for the drive. So I've got something to enjoy on the drive. So I have driven and cheesied at the same time. And, you know, you can eat and drive safely, I think.
So what I'm hearing is we've got three Timmy Typicals here, and you're the only David Daft. He's David Daft.
Yeah, can we talk about that list, actually? He says, don't be Norman Normal, be Cray Crazy. Don't be Timmy Typical, be David Daft. Now, of course, we'll all have clocked the David Daft reference there. I thought that was quite interesting. Like, I feel I would kind of assume using that name is just a bit of an Easter egg for long-time Coogan Partridge fans. Basically for nerds like us to clock. Because I think it's quite unlikely that David Daft, the comedian, would exist in the APU, particularly when so other kind of like real celebrities are often referenced in the APU. It'd be weird if David Daft existed and that would be a person for Alan to reference as well. I just don't think it makes sense. I think it's just a bit of extra fun for Coogan there.
Definitely, yeah. So he has a new jingle, which he's been road testing. I enjoyed the gradual step down from this being something that was genuinely positively received with each new bit of information he gives us. So he says that it was the response to the track was broadly positive amongst people who were forced to listen to it based on a straw poll that he conducted in a men's changing room.
That is the place as well to test new ideas. The changing room of a gym who you've coerced people into hearing your kind of new jingle.
My favourite bit of that whole section is him describing how Clive, in order to dry himself, bends over in front of the hand dryer and gets Alan to watch the door. Absolutely amazing. That absolutely did me when I first listened to it. So he mentions that there's been audience research from Audible. So again, I think we're pretty much one for one Audible references per episode of Oast House. And that he needs to broaden his appeal. And one of the potential demographics he's looking at is the Sunday Times reading woman over 60 that likes to keep a tidy front garden. And I did wonder if this bears any relation to real feedback, or whether we think it's a case of let Audible worry about the demographics and just keep writing Oast House for as long as it's financially viable and creatively fulfilling. Do you think there's been any conversation between Audible and the writers of Oast House about broadening Alan's appeal?
I think if you're getting into bed with Alan Partridge, you know what that demographic is, and your company as big as Amazon are going to strategically work with podcasts that hit different demographics rather than taking an existing one and going, let's expand it. Maybe that's more like from the writers to consider, I think, than Amazon, but they're so massive that they can basically promote a podcast that targets pretty much every demographic.
But what, is Alan naked in bed if they're getting into bed with him though?
Never that.
I thought it was, I mean, I always enjoy the Audible references because it's a bit knowing, it's a bit kind of bit of a nudge and a wink towards the fourth wall, isn't it? But lines like, don't worry about middle-aged, middle-class, white male divorcees, you've got them, they're safe. You know, I think there is a bit of a thing where obviously the writing team, they know exactly where their bread is buttered in terms of what the core audience is as well. And things like, be realistic, you're never going to attract teenage girls, and quite frankly, post-U-tree, it's more trouble than it's worth. And then there's a bit of a dig at Rod Liddell as well, when Alan says people are just dying to get the wrong end of the stick and hit you with it. I'll text that to Liddell now, I don't mean the supermarket. Rod Liddell, of course, quite a right-wing columnist, famously featured in the Stuart Lee routine many years ago, if anybody remembers that. I also really loved the demographics that Audible say are up for grabs, and I loved the idea that they would actually go to this level of specificity, that Alan could and should be aiming to appeal to white female geography teachers aged 35 to 45, as talks about the Sunday Times Reading Woman over 60 with a neat and tidy front garden, literally a garden, and single men over 50 with independent means. So those seem to be the three core demographics up for grabs of Alan. I also thought this is a great kind of end lines of this section. Audible want your money, I want your ears, I don't give two hoots what colour they are. He's just so open.
He's culturally colourblind. And he's open to feedback now after he's spoken to Amal Rajan. I know you're all big fans, but he put him onto a book about... Was it a book about monks where it says that letting go of hate can be empowering? And I did think that, is Alan a hateful person? No, but he definitely needs to let go of some of the emotions that kind of weigh him down. So, you know, it's good that he's keen to do that.
I'd say he's not a hateful person, but I would say he's a grudgeful person. I think he harbours resentment rather than hatred. I enjoyed that he said of Amal Rajan that his lazy enunciation had revolutionised Radio 4's Today Show.
I thought that was brilliant. Really enjoyed.
And on the topic of monks and recommendations, he also mentions that he once workshopped Monk Vibe as the name for a clothing brand, but then he imagines a jumper that Monk Vibe created that cost £300. And for the first time in a while, he's lost an argument with himself as he then tells his own invented clothing brand to fuck off.
That was going to be my intro quote, actually. Monk Vibe, jumper, £300. Fuck off.
Time for heavy thinking, Kat.
But what a weird advert. The first time I listened to this, I wasn't sure whether I'd heard it correctly, like what it was at the beginning. And then as it progressed, it's like, no, I did hear the kilogram hat.
It makes absolutely no sense, but it has been invented by a 15-year-old Chinese boy.
It's the new hat that the government doesn't want you to know about.
It's a 5-kilogram hat that comes with neck support and has a fiber optic neurotransmitter. But just a couple of things on this. Yeah, it makes no sense. The only thing I could think is that it might be a bit of a veiled reference to the Apple Vision, given that that is A, heavy, and B, has to be plugged in. And it's been getting some stick around the time that we wrote that this series was written.
I think it's probably doing a couple of things. It probably is that, but I think it's also probably having a bit of a pop at maybe like conspiracy theorist loons that have, you know, heard about this hat, and apparently this hat can fix, was it mood swings, your sex drive, and, you know, the government don't want you to know about it, and it's so ludicrous as a proposition, but it's kind of a bit of a nod and a wink to some of the things that people will, the extremes that people will go to try and fix things, even though it sounds absolutely mental.
Did everyone try going to heavythinkinghat.com?
I've literally just done that. Sadly, not operational.
Nothing there. Heavythinkinghat.
Yeah, Nick, I think you're right. It feels a bit like, you know, designed by a 15-year-old Chinese boy. It's like, this is like a product built to appeal to people that reside on 4chan and stuff like that. But yeah, it's supposed to improve memory, concentration, sex drive, and mood swings. So it does a lot, but it also sounds bad and wrong.
Is it time to move on to the legal letter from Gordon Granger, the Plymouth singer-songwriter, who is accusing Alan of plagiarism from Melancholy on the Mayflower?
He's seeking damages of half a million? I thought this stood out as absolutely ludicrous, irrespective of who penned the song first. There's no way that Gordon can be getting £500,000 out of Alan for this, surely.
Well, Gordon Granger's seen the association with Audible and Amazon and gone, hello, I can make some money here.
He wants to be drenched.
He wants to be drenched in cash.
It's a drenching.
Alan also references the lady in the pub where he says she smokes a bit, but she's up for fun and games, which I think is giving more credence to Alan having a bit of a penchant for women who like to smoke.
Yeah, definitely.
Seems to be a bit of a through line there.
In this, he did something so out of character. He tried to punch a friend and called him a cunt at the suggestion that they use his body for science in order
pickle
to pay
that,
this
you
half
cunt.
A mil that he owes. So he's been forced to re-record the jingle. It all reminded me a little bit of when we included the Alan Partridge signature in a very early version of the podcast and were sternly set straight by Steve Coogan's agent, who ironically we had called first.
I do like that Alan admits that he has plagiarised and copied one thing in his life, and that was the hand gesture from David Cameron where you like close the fist and like use the point with the thumb. I quite like
that. Isn't that because it can be deemed as it's rude to point, so you're bringing the fingers in, so you're
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I'm glad you made it.
There's a weird bit here where he's just sort of naming and playing instruments for a good minute, and I was expecting a better payoff than just a very overproduced jingle. I don't know if there's more to it, and I missed something here, but...
No, it's strange, isn't it? I mean, I've literally got that same note here where it's like, Alan goes around testing the instruments, but kind of why? Is it just filling for time?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I did like the bit just before that where Alan talks about one of Nathan's jingles, which was all the haters, see you laters, mash your brain like a pan of potatoes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Is that the Eminem style one that they're working on? It just needs a fat beat behind it.
Fat beat.
Also, did you guys notice as well, and I thought this was a very well-observed thing, that essentially you hear Alan kind of like his throat dries up every time he mentions the amount of money because it's stressing him out so much. I thought that was really, really well done. It's quite subtle. You don't necessarily clock it on first listen, I think.
And then there's a jingle or an ad for Norwich Neighbourhood Watch shopper benefit cheat in association with Cayman Investments, which is a lovely...
So good.
Absolute Coogan heartland territory, isn't it? a nudge about people picking on low-level benefit cheats while overseas investments pilfer much sums.
Very nicely done.
the best bit was the payoff there, where he's just like, even if you've got no evidence and just suspect someone of cheating, give us a call anyway.
So I think the organisation here is the Norwich Neighbourhood Watch and Taxpayer Alliance 2023 Shopper Benefit Cheat Campaign in association with Cayman Investments. And I love the tagline here, benefit fraud, they're robbing you.
So good. This is definitely file under funny, good, more of this.
So better than heavythinkinghat.com.
No, I thought I would put Heavy Thinking Hat under funny. It was ridiculous, but I thought it was good.
It's weird but funny, whereas some of these are just plain not funny or just plain weird.
So Alan calls Gordon's solicitor, Edward Halsey. He's got Gordon by the Jaffers. His recording isn't from 2018 because he could hear someone discussing the Iger Grey in the background, which didn't come out until 2021. Therefore, Gordon has plagiarised Alan's jingle. And as he says, he now needs to provide the right paperwork and voila, a viola.
This is an example of one of the times where Alan comes up on top in a situation. And it is always nice to see those things happen because Alan absolutely rinses him, like you say, gets him by the Jaffers. He knows his onions, Range Rover wise, and absolutely does him. So it's always nice to have those little segments when Alan comes out on top in a situation.
I liked his to kind of seal his victory here. He says to the solicitor, "I forgive you unconditionally for your sin, but try pulling a fast one like that again, and I will rinse you so royally, you and your family will end up moving into a hostel." Very, very vicious when he's victorious as well, which I'm not surprised about.
Tied directly, I think, to the stress of potentially losing £500,000 that he doesn't have. I thought it was good that although he comes out on top, he stood to lose £500,000 and he's ended up getting a £500 donation to a children's charity. So even, you know, they couldn't give him too big a victory because it would change the trajectory of Partridge too much. So it's still a small win, but a win is a win.
And actually it's quite interesting that, you know, that really paints Alan in a very positive light in terms of he's not even chasing down money to come to him. The fact is to go direct to a charity as well.
Makes me wonder if we're actually getting the truth, or maybe there was some additional sum sent directly to Alan that's just not mentioned in the podcast.
Well, he's obviously just, he's taken immediate influence from the book about being a monk, isn't he? So he's turning the other cheek. And I do like, actually, just to go back to earlier in the episode where he's talking about how he's got a dressing gown with a hood and a belt, where he stands in front of the mirror and says, what is it? I've got it here. I would make a good monk. Amen.
Yeah.
So a bit disappointed by this episode overall, I think. I mean, mainly for me, there's no callback to Michael, and I was hoping for one. I thought there might, at least what they did in previous series is they sort of forgot about the topic until the latter half of the episode after, and then they remembered. But absolutely nothing here, and I wondered if perhaps the order of the episodes had even been changed. Maybe they'd moved the Michael heavy episodes closer to the end for a more impactful finish. But yeah, always keen to hear Michael followed up on.
I think that's an interesting point, that there's definitely, they have to work on the pacing of this series, that, you know, if we're getting all the Michael heavy episodes by episode 5, then if and when that storyline runs its course, then you have an episode like this, that's going to even feel even more disappointing, I would think. So yeah, they've probably had to make a few tough decisions about how they drop the episodes in terms of the ones that are narrative or like mythology episodes, like we've talked about, all the kind of standalone, because yeah, this could go anywhere in the series, actually, this one, couldn't it? If that's in a way, I feel like, would it almost have worked? It might have worked better earlier in the series, thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, it's more kind of, it's closer to Alan Cannon, you know, recording a radio jingle or a podcast jingle than perhaps even the return to hospital radio or some of the things that we've had in earlier episodes. Before we finish this episode, has anyone got anything else on episode 5?
I just had two more observations to share, really. I thought the bit at the Racket Club where it suggested he sells his body not as a sex worker but as a medical research, I thought, again, just a really good example of Alan's imagination going to a dark place and letting him down, because we get this whole imagined scenario about him being a sex worker, which finds him at a real like low ebb and is actually like quite dark and just a bit kind of odd. But again, I think accurate in terms of what we know Alan's imagination always does. So it does make sense. And I thought the nice joke about the new jingle obviously it's very OTT in terms of the instrumentation. It's bigger. There's loads more going on in it. But actually the song structure and the melody is exactly the same. So, you know, he's just added electric guitars to it. So actually this new version wouldn't have helped the legal case at all because the song structure is identical.
I did assume that that's a joke that they're sort of making.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Because I was expecting it to be, and I was kind of like almost disappointed because obviously the joke is it isn't really that different, but also I didn't think that it made for a particularly funny payoff. So it works as a sort of joke, but is it actually that funny? Not really. And we're not reviewing the episode, but it was far from one of my favourites, I would say.
So, moving on to the second episode we're tackling today, episode 6, it's time to coronate a king with episode 6, Coronation, 22 minutes 15. How do Audible describe this one, Tom?
Our official synopsis for episode 6 is, broadcasting from his kitchen, Alan provides unofficial live commentary on the coronation of King Charles III.
Now, before we get into the meat of the episode, I don't know if anyone else had this, but I think this is something that was put out early, isn't it, as a
yeah.
teaser for Audible. Not that long after the actual coronation, right? I don't think it followed the coronation by much. I also thought it was interesting that we've heard that series 2 and 3 of Oast House were originally designed to be put out at the same time, but I don't think this coronation had actually happened until after series 2 came out. So this must be a new recording since series 2 of Oast House. So they can't have had all the episodes and then decided to cut the series in 2. I think there must have been some new content provided at least.
I imagine they must have gone, Alan would absolutely have something to say about this, or there must be something we can do to time with this. If we're going to be putting out a new series around this sort of time, let's jump on it as quickly as we possibly can.
Yeah, and you're right that Audible posted this episode on YouTube, and the top comment on the YouTube video at the time I looked was, I listen to Alan Partridge's audiobooks and podcasts each evening before sleep to help me cope with a waking nightmare of the reality we all live in. I combine that with looking in the mirror and slapping myself around the face while screaming, you've got to get through this.
Nick, don't you listen to this every single night before you go to bed?
I do. I think that comment is from a person that also probably sleeps in the nude in bed. But yes, it's part of my nightly routine. Just pop on from the Oast House and I find that within about 10-15 minutes, I'm sleeping soundly. Although the dramas of the world aren't weighing on me quite as much as that man. And I hope he's doing okay. Or could be a woman.
And the you've got to get through this, that is a quote from one of his self-help things, isn't it? I can't remember which one now, but yeah.
one of the many. Ford Solutions, there are others.
First thing I noticed is we're back to the old jingle. So the fruits of the previous episode will never be used again. And he's scolding Rosa, I think, at the very start
immediately.
Of this official, or unofficial, but official to him, coronation coverage starts with him having a pop at his own cleaner.
To be fair, dirty plates in with clean. Come on, Rosa, you're better than that.
Is the scene setting here that he's talking about being a BBC TV centre in September 1994?
Yes.
Because I thought Bruce Forsyth's leaving day.
Bruce Forsyth is finishing his stint on the Generation Game. In my head, like as a youngster, Bruce Forsyth did the Generation Game for like 20 years, and was just always the host. But after doing a bit of research, he only did it from 1990 to 1994, and then it became Jim Davidson's Generation Game from 1995 to 2002. So Jim Davidson actually hosted it for longer than Bruce Forsyth did. But in my mind, growing up, like Bruce Forsyth did it the whole time.
I'm forever in my head playing a game of Jim Davidson's Generation Game.
Redacted because it's ripe for misinterpretation.
I'm pretty sure there's a host before Jim Davidson, Bruce Forsyth. So I think it was someone else before Brucey.
Yeah. Larry Grayson, I think.
Larry Grayson, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yep.
It also rang a chord with me because I met Bruce Forsyth at BBC TV Centre the year before this, coming out of a filming of that episode of Noel's House Party that I was on that time.
Does that give us another excuse to put that clip on socials?
a bunch of slightly more starstruck children surrounded Bruce, who then very reluctantly signed autographs for them before getting in a cab.
Can I say, I really enjoyed the way Alan paints the picture of Television Centre in 1994. It's the clink of glasses, the stench of cigar smoke, and the rumble of men's laughter.
Also, isn't it sugar? He calls it a sugar.
Quite possibly.
Yeah, it's another inexplicable misspoken word. So yeah, instead of cigar, he's calling it a sugar. No idea why.
I did note as well, not long after that, he said, in Alan's words, he wanders into the room instead of the room as well.
There's so many errors as well. In fact, this episode is I'd say peak error, because there is so many words that I had to check whether they were actual words or not. Also, I mean, I don't know about you guys. Had you heard of Marmaduke Hussey?
No. I had to
only
look him up.
Yeah. Only because Marmaduke Hussey was featured in the most recent series of The Crown, I think.
Yes.
So that's the only, but again, only recently, but was genuinely the DG of the BBC for a period of time.
In the days when you could still say chairman.
Yes.
I like that he says he was speaking to him for what feels like an hour or 40 minutes. The distinction between those two things being so trivial.
And so effectively the thrust of this is that he wanted to do the Prince of Wales coronation and was trying to get in, 30 years early, predicting presumably a shorter life for Her Majesty the Queen. And then what still wants the BBC to honour the promise. The BBC will not honour the promise.
No.
So he's honouring the promise to himself. A question to the group. If Alan's coverage were on a TV channel, what percentage of people do you think would split off from the official coverage to watch Alan? I reckon he could peel off a good 10% of viewers, at least.
Oh, what? So do you mean like if in real life the BBC did commentary?
I mean, in real life, there are probably a lot of people that give less than two figs about a coronation, but the opportunity to watch a sort of satirical Partridge commentary, I think, would get them tuning in.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch the coronation. Yeah. I've got no interest in watching the coronation. But if there was a live version of Steve as Alan doing a alternative commentary, I would absolutely watch that.
Yeah, I did think about this because I agree. I think he would have done phenomenally well. But I just think there's a reality where there's no way the BBC, particularly, you know, current day and age, the amount of pressure and scrutiny they're always under, there's no way the BBC would risk essentially enraging the royal family by doing something like this. It's actually the sort of thing you could see Channel 4 might have done, because they always have like an alternative Queen's speech and stuff like that. Because, yeah, I think
King's speech,
they could have had
some respect.
Well, they've not had a King's speech yet, or have they? No, they've had one.
They've had one.
I think you're right. It could have been a huge like broadcast moment, but yeah, there's no way the BBC would actually touch it with a barge pole, is there?
No. Alan claims that his commentary matches the BBC footage exactly. I don't know if anybody bothered to check this out. It does sound like it could. When it was put on YouTube, was it matched to BBC footage?
No,
then?
So I did test this out. So the video that Audible put up is just like a static Oast House artwork video. It doesn't have the BBC footage, because again, there's no way that I think the BBC would allow that to happen. That's also the thing. The BBC could have done this as like an iPlayer shorts or a YouTube short thing, but again, as discussed, no way that would really happen. But I think there was an 18-minute video on YouTube where the visuals were synced with this episode, but the bitter bastards at BBC Studios took it down.
Oh, really?
Somebody I know has it on a Google Drive and sent me the link, so I did actually... I basically synced up the Audible episode on my phone and the YouTube video on my laptop. And it's interesting, actually, because it doesn't perfectly sync up. There are a few things that happen. Well, particularly when he talks to Rosa. Rosa's audio is a little bit different. It's a little bit quieter. And I think perhaps it doesn't match word for word. So that at some point, they've obviously gone back and re-recorded, at the very least, Rosa's parts of the episode.
Right,
And also, because I think, how long is this episode on Audible? Like 22 minutes or something? The YouTube version that I've seen and that was up on YouTube for a bit was 18 minutes. So there are some bits that are cut, but they're not the bits you might expect, because there are some bits later in the episode which are potentially a bit kind of possibly like slanderous or something, and it's not that. It's just like a few bits where it's just quite waffly and not particularly funny anyway. So but on the whole, apart from those weird bits where the episode doesn't sync, in terms of the visuals, it kind of matches. But really, most of the visuals, it's just like the procession. So there isn't that much that it really has to tie into. It's mainly the bit at the end, like the last 2 minutes when the crown is being put on. It's that bit where it really sinks, and that's the most fun bit.
Definitely. Because I would say sort of like the beginning of this episode, quite interesting and good. The end of this episode, funny. The middle of it, a little bit, you know, just so it's very obviously train of thought from Alan, because he's kind of reacting to things happening in real time in the APU, so to speak. But a couple of highlights for me. This, of course, the horse's day, every bit as much as His Majesty's. And also Alan saying that the Audi Quattro was the king's favourite car. Those are a couple of my highlights.
I enjoyed where he's talking about Patriots being able to take off their plastic Union Jack bow tie. There's lots of lols throughout this episode at the expense of sort of Patriots that convey it through ugly tat.
Flag shaggers.
Yes.
Yeah.
He says, what a gay day, with the champagne in his hand. I did predict at this point in my notes that he'd be hammered by the end.
And yes.
I think maybe not hammered, but certainly the quality of the commentary goes off a cliff.
That was my kind of hope, that was going to be the payoff, that he got progressively more and more drunk and did something bad and wrong. But maybe that's the obvious thing. But
I feel like as well that to begin with, when you first hear him slurping a drink, you don't actually know what he's drinking. So the fact they layer that in is like, oh no, he is on the fizz and he is getting boozed. First of all, you think maybe he's like having a cup of tea or something. And Stab, to your point, I would agree that I think in the middle, it is a bit of a lull, because it's not really that funny, and he's kind of just, yeah, he is kind of filling the time to narrate stuff that isn't that interesting visually. But on the flip side, I would actually say when you are actually watching the visuals, because it grounds it in a more realistic Alan Partridge commentary mode, I think it actually is a better experience.
Yeah, that makes sense, because obviously you have sort of like, I know it's a completely different era of Partridge, but Alan Partridge's Road to World Cup 94, yeah, whenever he's describing football, and that's obviously funny. So
yeah, and replay of that, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So I guess this, you know, Welby moves in for the crown when synced up with the actual footage would be quite funny.
Yes, yeah.
I think the reason I really love parts of this episode are that they've really gone to town on the whole Trojan horse of Alan respectfully delivering absolute swipes at the royal family. I love saying, well, he says that part of it looks like a royal blue cornrow, presumably a tribute to our Caribbean territories and the reggae music so adored by the king's father. I like that when he's talking about Harry and William, he says, many will look upon the medals and ask, but what are they for?
Yeah.
he says, but of course they are for something, because Harry's completed 2 tours of Afghanistan and William's completed 3 tours of Anglesey.
I love that he adds on that as well. He's like, do you mind? That's actually a very rude question and is none of your business.
Some other bits as well. I feel during this episode more than anything, I feel sad that I'm robbed of being able to give a quote at the top of the episode, because I'd love to have done the truly resplendent in what can only be described as their resplendiosity. And also that the horses haven't put a hoof wrong.
What I would say is that probably not the funniest episode, but actually thinking back to it, it's a very well written episode, because you have to write. From a writing point of view, from a technical point of view, the writing is very, very good.
Yeah, and talking about swipes at the royal family, I particularly enjoyed this one when it's a misspoken word, but when Alan says that he's referencing the royal carriage, which is bedicting old.
That's great.
I do think this is probably, it's not a series highlight, but it's probably one of the series' most quotable episodes. There's a bit where he's like, the Queen consort there. I once went to a Queen concert. It was fantastic. I mean, his other wife was friends with Freddie Mercury, wasn't she? The carriage looks like one for Disney princesses, but the occupants are a long way from being Disney princesses, and I mean both of them.
there's just, again, more digs at Nicholas Witchell, which are always fun.
I love that bit.
And how much the royal family hate Nicholas Witchell. Like, if the Queen saw him fall into a bin, he would absolutely piss himself.
And also, it was if you saw him not have an umbrella in the rain or be moved on by a policeman, King Charles would love that. Really made me laugh.
And isn't there a reference at some point to how much the people of Wales hate Nicholas Witchell? I think because he's since retired, and I looked up online. Wales Online put it in their headline: "Awful man, Nicholas Witchell has retired." That was the headline.
I feel like, is this the point as well where we get a bit of a Rob Brydon dig as well, and they call Alan obviously calls him out as having an MBE, but that's obviously a bit of a sort of dig in the ribs from Coogan to Brydon, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's brilliant, because you see he's talking about Michael McIntyre. He says, "Here, I'm sure somewhere would fellow monarchist Rob Brydon MBE." Yeah. You just know brilliant. That Coogan has absolutely loved getting that line into that script.
Yeah,
and right in amongst the section about how the rest of Wales have no time for the royal family. Yeah. Rob Brydon's the only one. A lovely bit as well. He says, faces in the crowd, happy to get a glimpse of the King and Queen, though less so the Queen, as she made Diana sad.
Yeah. I mean, it is a real kind of tangent, but I liked it when he was having this the kind of imagined conversation where he's flirting with the Mona Lisa regarding smirking.
Yeah.
He says, a little saltiness appropriate for the 16th century. Men had a cracking time then. They really did.
Yeah.
There are a lot of great lines in this episode, 100%. And I think they're all very true to the Alan character. And if it, I think, you know, like we're saying, you could imagine Alan saying a lot of this in 90s iterations of the character as well. I think he's really grounded in that sort of world.
There's a lot of fun to be had as well in all of the things that he thinks are inappropriate to bring up on a day like today. So he says that the coronation is not a day for zips. And then he works out that the combined weight of the royals is about 24 to 25 stone. And looking for comparisons, he asks Rosa how much a sack of potato weighs. She answers in kilograms, and he goes, "Not kilograms, not today, Jesus."
That's a lovely touch.
I also think it is a stroke of genius to include a section where it talks about how there's actual people on the royal payroll whose job it is to stretch the gloves to make sure that they can fit Charles's sausage fingers.
Finger fatness.
And that's why it's not going on the BBC, basically.
Yes, that's it.
Fat pig sausages.
Yeah. Also mentions that violent chubby babies are a common theme of art in the 16th century, and in some of the artwork we're looking at, all principalities are represented except Wales, but that's fine. Going on to say, a further dig at Wales, His Majesty hates Doctor Who, and he's right to do so.
You know what? Having discussed this episode, maybe I will go back.
Suddenly,
to
it's great
because I haven't listened to it for a couple of weeks since doing the notes on this. So maybe I'll go back and listen to it with fresh ears and come to appreciate it a lot more. Because when I was doing the notes, I was like, I'm not sure this is a great episode, but actually talking back through it, it does actually make it sound it's better than I originally thought.
So it's time to take a fresh look at episode 6, Coronation.
Correct. Suddenly, it's the best episode of the series.
There's further digs into the other nations of UK, the UK, when he says that that he's had resounding victories in all his wars, Iraq, Afghanistan and Northern Ireland, reframing the Troubles as a war against Northern Ireland, which he won, I thought was particularly insensitive. And also, there's an Oliver Cromwell bit that I feel like doesn't really go anywhere, but then he starts getting into the attendees at the coronation and sort of picking on individual politicians, and that bit I think is really great. So he's referring to Rory Stewart as being in an outfit from a charity shop, looking like buttons from Panto.
That's good. Did you talk about Penny Mordaunt as well? I really like her. It's like, not surprised
to be honest,
by that.
I do as well.
I like that Penny Mordaunt has the spike of justice as well. Some talk about the tradition and rarity of a coronation. He says it's an event we've not seen in the country for 70 years and we'll not see again for 10 to 15 if he's lucky. And that convention prevents William from just getting a buzz cut and being done with it, talking about William's slow descent into boldness.
Have you seen there's a meme about that, which is like, what's stopping him, where it's basically buzz cut on top and like a shaped up beard, and it's been like, yeah, he would look a lot better if he just went for that look, but
he must be gutted he didn't leave the royal family first. He could have a buzz cut and be in LA by now. There's a bit of talk about the Falklands. He talks about how he's hobnobbed with, play polo with aristocrats, rich Arabs and professional Argentine polo players. And whilst he may not have triumphed at polo, when the prize was a little island called the Falklands, my God, he triumphed. going on to say that Falklands has five different types of penguins, and surely that's worth fighting for, which brings me to my quiz. Which of these is a legit type of Falklands penguin?
Great.
So I'll go by group consensus. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 to choose. The first one is rockhopper. A real Falklands penguin, or have I made it up?
That sounds real to me.
Yeah, it could be real. I would go real for that.
I'm not sure, but I'll go with the group and we'll say it's real.
That is one of the official Falklands penguins worth fighting for.
Yes.
Second one on the list, macaroni.
No.
It feels, yeah, but also it feels so daft that maybe it's true.
Remember, we did have a car called Lettuce the other week, didn't we?
Yeah, and a Vauxhall Lettuce, whatever it was.
So are we saying there's such a thing as a macaroni penguin?
Macaroni penguin.
All right, go on.
Real. Correct. There is a macaroni penguin.
Two for two.
The third penguin, Jack.
Jack
yes.
penguin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because you'd have like a jackdaw, wouldn't you? Like a
go on then, bird. Say yes. So,
yeah, yes, real. Nope, it's not worth fighting for. I've made it up. is this a real Falklands penguin?
The Jack penguin?
Gentoo.
Can you spell it, please?
Yes, it's G-E-N-T-O-O.
Feel like that's a thing I've heard of, but was it a penguin? I do not know.
Penguin.
Should we say... Well, there's eight and five of them are right, so... should we say it's true?
Go on, then.
Yeah.
Say yes.
Gentoo is a genuine Falklands penguin.
Come on.
Next on the list. Thatcher.
No. Get out.
No.
Behave.
No. That would be a penguin that Alan would want to fight for.
Yeah, it's a penguin too far.
It's Gen too far. It's a penguin too far. It's gone the way of the dodo. The Thatcher penguin is not a real penguin. The fifth is Magellanic. The Magellanic penguin.
I feel like that is not a word that's come out of Adam's mind. I think that's definitely true.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's sound reasoning. Let's say true.
It's correct. It is a real penguin. The penultimate penguin is King.
King penguin's real,
I think.
But is that
isn't
a Falklands
Emperor?
Penguin, though?
Is it,
I think is that the game
got,
he's
it's
playing
It's the one
here.
That's kind of got like the plume.
King
I don't
penguin?
Think
isn't it Emperor the, penguin?
I don't think we're
oh,
doubting that
right.
The King penguin could exist, but does it exist in the Falklands?
I'm going to say
right.
No. I think it exists
Let's
elsewhere.
Say no. Let's say no.
It's a trick question. It exists elsewhere, not on the Falklands.
No, it exists in the Falklands.
Oh,
it is one of the five. And so that might be something of a giveaway, but your final Falklands penguin is the common.
So that is real.
Isn't it false? Because we've had Jack, the other one.
I think it's false.
It will, by process of elimination, I think it's false.
Okay.
Yeah. Nick's been doing the maths. It is false. The king is real. The commoner is not.
Okay, 5 out of 8.
5 out of 8. I'll take that.
That was confusing me with the numbers. I was just keeping track of what we got right, not what was
right.
True and false.
Alan's now at the end of his bottle of champagne, so we were kind of right. He's fairly sozzled. Again, talking about what's appropriate for a coronation. He says, on a day like this, all movements should be done with an extreme slowness. Oh, and the Penny Mordaunt's outfit has just a hint of Star Trek.
Is it after he's talking about Penny Mordaunt that you get to the coronation oven glove? And the speculation, and I think this way you can tell he definitely is a bit sozzled, speculating it's a nod to the late musical nonce, Michael Jackson.
Pop nonce.
Yes. Yep.
Now, so this is the thing where I was saying about the durations not quite matching when I was watching and listening. And I thought, oh, well, that's going to be a bit that they'll have cut in terms of it being on YouTube. Not that it was an official upload anyway, I guess, but... it's actually the bit that is cut is about all the stuff about the glove maker. So it's quite a boring bit anyway. But I'm amazed that they didn't cut the late musical nonce line. But there we go.
At the point that he's talking about people expressing concern about how the ordinary glove will accommodate the monarch's sausagey digits, it reminds him to get Rosa to put some sausages on.
Yeah,
that was nice.
Not the chipolatas.
The
Walls ones. Fat pig sausages.
That's one of those things that definitely going to be used from now on when talking
about
like
fat pig
sausages. Yeah, it's going to be fat pig sausages.
I think we get the first Grandad Graham memory of the series at this point as well.
Grandad.
Gets a bit teary. And then implies that it's a bit tight of the royal family to use a mixture of precious and semi-precious stones. I did look up the difference. So there are only four actual precious stones. Does anyone care to name them?
Diamond?
Is that like diamond, surely?
Sapphire. Diamond's one.
Sapphire. Sapphire's one.
Ruby.
Ruby. Ruby.
Emerald.
Yes, Emerald. You've got the big four.
My next one, yeah.
Where I looked it up, it says sometimes you can see that a pearl, an opal, or a jade are listed as a precious gemstone, but more often they are considered semi-precious.
The opaloid crisis.
And now we're on to Welby. So this is the bit where Alan's coronation coverage and football commentator past intersect.
Yeah.
I mean, I think would we all agree this is the best bit of the episode. I think this is like what.
Yeah,
pretty much the last 2 minutes of the episode, and I think this is a superb quotable Partridge.
Well, I'm happy to kick off. We do not want a cockeyed king was basically the standout quote for me. We do not want a cockeyed king.
I just love the way that he firmly moves into football commentary mode here. So suddenly, here we go. Welby moves in for the crown. He passes it. Surprise.
Yeah, bold move by Welby, but that's why they pay him the big bucks.
And I think it's almost literally not a stolen line, but a recreation line where at the end he's like, yes, that is a king.
Yep.
That was a goal.
If there's any doubt that Alan is sozzled from this whole bottle of champagne, this sort of crowning line, if you'll forgive the pun, that is a king, a kingly king, a godly king, a good king, a kind king. King Kong.
King Kong.
Bish bash bosh. Back to the palace for some nosh.
King Kong.
And then my only note following that, just a quote that I think requires no further explanation. Edwin Holmes said he'd be there. Nowhere to be seen. He's full of shit.
Yeah, he is pissed, isn't he?
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely
good.
Love that.
That's good. I mean, I'd be interested what if any listeners didn't like this, because I guess you could level an accusation that they are literally just, you know, they've put Alan into sports commentary mode and they're just repeating some of the beats exactly the same way they did in the World Cup roundup. But I mean, to me, like, I'm really happy to have Alan back in that mode, because we haven't really heard or seen that in a very, very long time.
Yep.
I think it's Alan kind of almost at his original best, in a way.
I think so too, and I think I could forgive some repetition, because the commentary stuff is so far in the past, you know, it's a different writing team. I also think it's less the commentary element, or sorry, less the football commentary element of it that makes it great. I think it's just that it's all wrapped around an event that we all recognise, we all know the sort of the history of it, we all know when he's making sort of references to like William's lack of military service and things like that, you all kind of know the backbone that those jokes are built on. And I think that having Alan do something that is kind of communal to the whole country adds a sort of an aspect that we haven't had for a very long time, because he's become more of a niche concern, less of a sort of, you know, less of a mainstream thing. And I think I think we were quite starved of anything funny and real around the coronation itself. You know, it was all Daily Mail tea towels and, you know, the pomp that you'd expect, and you didn't really see a lot of people kind of taking a blowtorch to that in the way that Alan does here. So I think that was a lot of fun, and I think that brings us to the end of this very regal episode of Monkey Tennis. So thank you so much for joining us. If you've got any thoughts on these two episodes, or indeed any other Alan Partridge output, we're on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, Facebook.com/The Partridge Pod. You can email thepartridgepod@gmail.com, or you can throw a couple of coppers down the well at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. Very keen to hear what you think about this series of Osthouse and this episode in particular. We'll be back next week looking at new grandkid followed by new friend. But until then, from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks and goodbye.
Didn't we do well?
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on the spine.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Okay.
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzock of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Monkey tennis?
Back of the net.
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.